cases, a U.S. judge warned Pierrot to investigate suspects properly before charging them. From WPFW and WBAI, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shairana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shairana Show. And you just heard the Maryam Shahab singing Hadha Salam. Is this a peace? Today we're going to have a long, very informative segment that Jadalia did. For those of you who are not familiar with Jadalia, it's run, the senior editor is Bassam Haddad, who we've had this show. He works a lot with Moin Rabbani, who also one of the best analysts on the topic of the Arab world. And they do regular episodes, and they have a podcast. They have the Jadalia podcast, among many other projects. And I've been trying to wrap my head around what is really happening regionally, you know, kind of pulling out of the horror that we're witnessing, especially in the wake of the fact that the UN finally woke up. And I know members of the UN have been fighting for this, but the UN finally woke up and declared what's happening right now in Gaza is genocide committed by Israel. And, you know, the UN joins a series of more than a dozen human rights organizations, the most prominent ones in the world, like Amnesty International or Doctors Without Borders, or, you know, local ones like B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization. They've joined them in declaring that this is genocide. So there is no more denying this. anymore. I witnessed something the other day in a live interview with a UN commissioner who was asked that the Israeli response was that this declaration about Israel being committing genocide is done by Hamas proxies. The whole thing, the Hamas thing, that's repeated by the Israelis is getting old, and he was tired of it, and he says, "This is getting boring." I've never seen a UN commissioner reply in that sense. He said, "This is getting to be boring." You know, they never, he says, meaning the Israelis, they never confront the evidence before them. They just say Hamas, Hamas, every time we issue a statement or a human rights organization. And it's no longer working. That's why they're putting millions and millions of dollars trying to buy out things like CBS and other outlets, which have very low ratings, but nonetheless dumping hundreds of millions of dollars in that. And as the UN commissioner said, you would think with the this entity putting so much money into public relations that they would come up with different excuses or different confront the evidence in a more sophisticated way, but apparently it's not happening. But anyway, it is important that the UN has declared that this is a genocide. And so now with this with what about we are about to hear is it's the Jedalia interview that brings together, of course, Bassam Haddad, Moin Rabbani, and one of my favorite analysts, especially when it comes to issues of the Middle East and specifically Iran, is Trita Parsi. So they're asking him questions about Iran, Israel, and the failing global humanitarian, basically whatever was set up post-World War II has been completely demolished by the US and Israel. So let's have a listen to this long interview with Trita Parsi.
Yeah.
Claudia Jones School for Political Education, the Venezuela Solidarity Network, Friends of Latin America, and Code Pink invite you to a panel discussion on communes in Venezuela and solidarity in the face of U.S. aggression that will take place on Wednesday, September 17th from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Institute for Policy Studies. Speakers include Vanessa Perez, a spokesperson of the Cinco Fortalezas Commune, Juliana Barnett and Abena Distro of the Claudia Jones School, and Leonardo Flores of the Venezuela Solidarity Network. The event, Solidarity with the Venezuelan People from Inside the Belly of the Beast, Opposing Imperialism and Supporting Sovereignty, will take place on Wednesday, September 17th from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Institute for Policy Studies on 1301 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. More information about how to register can be found online at www.codepink.org/DC917. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome, everyone, to Long Form Conversations, the podcast produced by Jedalia. Our inspiration for these discussions is the well-known quote by Antonio Gramsci, "The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." I'm Bassam Haddad, and together with my co-host, Moin Rabbani, we are exploring this theme with a series of guests whose work has provided valuable insights into these issues. For this episode, we're absolutely delighted to have with us Trita Parsi, award-winning author and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. Because of what happened today, and because of time constraints on all sides, we're not going to read the full bio, but it will be posted on Jedalia. Trita Parsi, first of all, a very warm welcome to Long Conversations. We're very much looking forward to having this discussion with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Maureen, would you like to get us started?
Yes. Trita, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on. I'd like to start with a question that we begin all our conversations with, and that is to ask you, are we experiencing a transformation or disintegration of the international order, or is this order experiencing yet one more challenge from which it will recover and perhaps emerge even stronger than before? Specifically, many people have described Israel's genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip as a final nail in the coffin of the international order established after the Second World War and of the institutions that have underpinned it. Do you agree with this assessment, or are we experiencing one more challenge like we have seen on multiple occasions previously and from which the system can be expected to recover?
Again, thank you so much for having us. A very big question. Let me first start off by saying all transformations more or less start off with some level of disintegration. And I do think that what we're seeing here is not a scenario in which the system actually recovers. I've not seen much recovery in the last two decades or so. But rather, I think it is the trend we should be focusing on. And the trend, I think, is crystal clear. This is a disintegration, which I hope will lead to a transformation. There's no guarantee, of course. But we have seen the hollowing out of international law and institutions for more than two decades. Let me go back to an op-ed that Richard Perl published on the day of the Bush administration invading Iraq in 2003. In it, he said that this will not only be good riddance of Saddam, but also of the UN as a whole. And he argued that the future security is not going to be upheld by any international institutions, but rather by a coalition of the willing of states. And from the neoconservative perspective, the UN was seen as an unacceptable constraint on American power. And as a result, it was pushing to undo it. And as you may recall, back then there was a debate whether Bush even should go to the UN and make the case for the invasion of Iraq, because in the view of some of the neoconservatives, that would legitimize the United Nations. So it was better to just do it and not even bother pretending as if the UN mattered. Now, there is a perception that other administrations, democratic administrations, have had a much more friendly perspective on the UN and multilateral system. And to a very large extent, at times that was true. I don't think the Obama administration shared that perspective of Richard Perl and the neoconservatives. But I think it's important to understand that towards the end of the Obama administration, and certainly by the time Biden came in, something had shifted. And you saw suddenly much more of the use of the term rules-based international order. It really takes off in 2015 when it was included in, I think, the last NSS of the Biden of the Obama administration.
Now, this is a national security strategy.
Exactly. There is a belief that, you know, rules-based order and the international order or the UN system is one and the same thing, but that clearly was not the perception. If you take a look at the 2022 NSS of the Biden administration, they talk about how it's important for countries to subscribe to the rules-based order, and if they do so, the United States would help them with their military defenses. It is talking about the rules-based order not as a universal order, but as a club, as a NATO plus. You subscribe to it, you become a member to it, and then you get military benefits. And in here is also very important to understand what the difference is between a rules order and a law order. I know you know much more about international law than I do. But at the end of the day, I'm sure you would agree with me that there is an objective, transparent process in which international law is formulated It is by and large consensual. Countries sign on to treaties and as a result are bound by those treaties. The United States never signed the Rome Statute and as a result does not have to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu when he arrives in Washington, whereas Germany has to, even though it now says that it won't. Whereas when it comes to rules, what is the process of formulating rules? Do you have a say in what those rules are? And it's really clear that rules is something that Western powers, particularly the United States, is putting together with the expectation and the performance of expecting that other countries are now bound by them. And I think that, too, is essentially a coalition of the willing approach towards international order, in which you're actually taking away from the legitimacy and the inclusiveness, with all of its faults, of the UN system and moving it towards a coalition of the willing approach, a rules-based order that you subscribe to, and to try to uphold not only order, but more importantly, Western dominance through it. And the danger in all of this, beyond the fact that, of course, it's hollowing out international law, and many international law experts are increasingly, or they were up until Trump came in, no one is using that term any longer, essentially saying that the rules-based order is a threat to international law, is that if the Chinese and the Russians then also start using similar things and they create their own rules-based order, then you will not only have a multipolar world emerging, but also a multi-order world, which in many ways would be much more dangerous than what you had during the Cold War. During the Cold War, there were clearly two different orders, but there was a super order above it with the UN, with international law, with the authority of the Security Council that both sides accepted. Both sides quarreled about how to interpret things, and at times they ignored the rules, but nevertheless, there was a mutual acceptance of its nominal authority. In a multi-order world, we will not be competing or arguing about the interpretation of law. We will have different sets of law. And I think that will be tremendously destabilizing and will make it very difficult to be able to address common threats such as pandemics and climate and things of that nature going forward. Now, again, taking it to Gaza and what the Trump administration is doing, I think right now we're seeing a very aggressive assault on the multilateral system as a whole. But I think it's a mistake to believe that that is the whim of the Trump administration or Trump as a person. It is manifested in a much more overt and aggressive way. But even prior to that, under Biden, there was an assault on it. It was just much, much more subtle. It was much more clever, perhaps, because it was under the guise of trying to protect the system. It was under the guise of status quo, protecting it from revisionism from China or Russia or whoever, whereas in reality, the rules-based order itself actually was fundamentally revisionist.
Well, you've answered my next question, which was to say many people are pointing to Gaza as the point of rupture, but why should we ignore, for example, something like the 2003 invasion of Iraq? And I think you've laid out clearly that actually you should look at Iraq as a key turning point. But you've partially answered the other follow-up, which is that if, as you seem to concur, the system is disintegrating and is transforming, where are we heading to? Is it this kind of multi-order system, or is it something perhaps more dangerous? Where does the transformation lead to? And is it going to be a very violent and rocky transformation, as we're already witnessing?
Historically, I think, again, we have to be honest, almost all transitions tend to be pretty violent and bloody and problematic. Transitions are the most destabilizing moments in international history. And I don't think this one is going to be any different. It's probably going to be much, much worse at the end of the day. I don't think it is clear, and I don't think it is inevitable where we will end up. I think that in some of the absolutely darkest moments, and I'm, you know, today in and of itself, given what just happened with the bombing of Qatar, there's much to be worried about where the direction of the international system as a whole is going. But I think there's also small things that perhaps can help lead us in a better direction. No guarantee whatsoever. The fact that Secretary of State Marco Rubio, very early in the Trump administration, said the world is multipolar. And by the way, unipolarity was a historical aberration and an abnormal state. It's actually very interesting. I mean, others have said that the world is multipolar. In fact, Hillary Clinton said it in 2010. But then suddenly it was impossible to say it because at some point, apparently, Putin has said it. And if you said that, then that was a Putin talking point under the Biden administration. But then Rubio comes in and says it. But more importantly, he says unipolarity was an abnormality, which then means, presumably, trying to restore unipolarity is not something the United States should engage in, because that would be to try to sustain an abnormal state of international affairs that cannot stand on its own legs. That makes it quite different from the Biden administration that really was trying to restore unipolarity and in many ways used Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine as a pretext to be able to move in that direction. Now, if you recognize, and this is the part that I think the administration doesn't recognize, but if you recognize that the world is multipolar, that the U.S. is no longer having the unipolar privilege that it did 20 or so years ago, it also means that your ability through your own hard power to constrain the behavior of rival states such as China or Russia is going to be much limited than it was before. So naturally, that would lead you, I hope, to think, well, in that case, I will need some alternative instruments to be able to protect myself, but also to constrain those rivals. And that's where international law and the multilateral system actually comes in. That's the bargain that every other state makes. They agree on constraints on themselves because it gets them constraints on others. And whereas that may not have been an attractive bargain when you were a unipolar power, if you admit and if you internalize that you are now in a multipolar world, you may still be the most powerful country in the multipolar system, but it is a multipolar world and you're no longer unipolar power, then I assume that at some point, if you think long and hard enough about it, there should be an attraction to international law, perhaps in a revised version. I'm sure everyone would have to want to see some changes to, but nevertheless, that's very different from the position of the neoconservatives who in the unipolar moment viewed international law as nothing but an unnecessary and illegitimate constraint on the United States with no benefits. And in this moment believes, no, multipolarity is an abnormality and it is in the interest of the United States to restore unipolarity. So again, I don't want to overstate this, but it is interesting and potentially hopeful that that first recognition has been achieved or has been reached. Whether that will lead to these other recognitions that I personally think logically comes from that remains to be seen. But at least theoretically, there's a path to it. Whereas if the president's name or if the Secretary of State name was John Bolton or Richard Perle, then I don't think that theoretical possibility even would have existed.
Thanks, Twitter. We're going to move to basically a related topic to this, you know, new emerging equation and how Iran might fit into it. This June, for example, we witnessed the first ever attack by a nuclear state, the United States, against the nuclear facilities of a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose facilities operate under the supervision of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. Should we view this as part of a broader effort to remake the global order, or was this war the product of unrelated dynamics that are specific to Iran? And then, of course, I have, you know, related to this question, a number of issues I'd like to raise with you.
Thank you, Asaf. I do think that this is highly related because I think at the very forefront, the tip of the spear of the effort to undo as many norms around the use of force, as many institutions of the international system, as much of international law as possible in order to create more of a law of the jungle type of a situation is actually the efforts in the foreign policy of Israel. I don't think it is a coincidence that there seems to be this systematic effort to constantly challenge boundaries and norms, such as the attack on Qatar today, such as the assassination of leaders in other countries, such as breaking all kinds of previous rules about limitations of collateral damage, etc., that the U.S. itself had imposed on itself and on those using its weapons, but now appears to have completely lifted when it comes to Israel. So I think it has been a long-standing position of the Israelis to try to undo these things because they see an advantage for them as a very sophisticated military power who has the ability to get the most powerful military power in the world to do much of its bidding, to pursue a world, to create a world in which those constraints do not exist any longer. So that, and when you see the ambassador of Israel go to the UNGA and tear apart the UN charter, this little thing that he had, then I don't think, you know, what I'm saying here is much speculation. They're doing it as openly as possible, tearing apart every rule of the charter that is the very foundation of international law and the international system. So attacking Iran and nuclear facilities of Iran, and which is a violation of the Geneva Conventions, Article 36, if I'm not mistaken, does something very interesting for them. They're breaking another norm, and then they're looking at the Europeans. And what did the Europeans do? They did not condemn it. Remember how much they condemned them when Russia attacked Ukrainian nuclear facilities. Now, not only was there dead silence from Europe, but even beyond that, now you had the German chancellor go out and say that Israel is doing Europe's dirty work for it. So it wasn't just a condemnation, it was an embrace. It was a congratulations to the Israelis. It was a thank you. It was an expression of support for how the Israelis were breaking international law, destroying international norms. And I think that is one of the biggest changes we have seen in the last couple of years. I'm not trying to say that Europe has been perfect in any way, shape, or form, but I do believe that they have played a very critical role of being on the forefront of trying to strengthen international law and international institutions. All countries, unfortunately, break them occasionally. Europe is no exception in this case. But Europe has been a driving force for a lot of these different agreements, everything from Paris or the Rome Statute that we talked about. I remember, you know, I grew up in Europe. I remember when it was signed in 1998. It was a celebration because it was seen as a civilizational leap forward, moving us away from a world in which power was stronger than law, but one that would actually have law being stronger than raw military power. And now it is the Europeans that more or less are on the forefront, following the Israelis and undermining these very institutions and laws and norms that they themselves played a critical role establishing.
Regarding the war itself in June, the Iranian leadership made no significant effort, to our knowledge, to my knowledge, to present the war in a regional context, and made conspicuously few references to Palestine. I would watch the speeches by Iranian leaders, and it was as though this was a separate event from what's happening in Gaza. And even in normal times, usually Palestine gets brought up, period. Did Iran too perceive this war as the product of a separate series of dynamics, or were there other motivations at play in its posture, or did they just want to deliberately separate things?
They wanted to deliberately separate things for reasons that have very little to do with Palestine and much more to do with their uncertainty on their end of how the Iranian public would react to this. It was important for them to be able to fuel and utilize nationalism, which I think occurred in a manner that was way beyond their expectation and had frankly very little to do with them. But the more they would have talked about Palestine, the more they would have undermined the manner in which nationalism, nationalistic fervor spread throughout Iran as a wave because of a tremendous anger at what the Israelis had done. This was seen as an Israeli attack on Iran. If you threw Palestine into it too overtly, it would have probably, and I'm speculating what their calculation was, they probably thought that that would have fueled other voices who have been in Iran for quite some time, people who have argued that Iran has unnecessarily dragged itself into a conflict with Israel by supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, by supporting many other groups in Iraq and Syria, etc., and that it would have been better if Iran had just minded its own business, in their view, and stayed away from those type of conflicts and that type of a foreign embroilment. But so to, under those circumstances, talk too much about Palestine, I think, would have undermined, from their perspective, the nationalistic fervor that was spreading. What is fascinating with that nationalism that spread, however, is that it actually, to a large extent, seems to have pushed back on this previous point that I just raised. Not to say that everyone fell in line, but that a lot of people started to agree with the logic that the regime itself or the government itself had put forward earlier on, which is that ultimately the support for Hezbollah, the support for groups in Iraq, is something that was needed in order to prevent war from coming to Iran's own territory. That, yes, there is an ideological dimension to it, but there is also a self-interested national interest perspective on this, which is that if it wasn't for these different groups, ISIS would have run over Baghdad and it would have tried to enter Iranian territory. If it wasn't for the strength of Hezbollah in 2006, Israel would have attacked Iran in 2006. So that argument, which to a large extent was rejected by a large people of the portion of the population because of anger at the regime for a whole set of other issues, and the belief that, you know, why are they unnecessarily dragging Iran into a conflict with a much more powerful military that has the support of the superpower, I think changed to a large extent. Whether that will remain the case or not, I cannot speculate about, but it changed to a large extent because the Israeli attack came at a moment where the Iranian government was sending clearer messages than ever before that it wanted to have a negotiation with the United States to reach a nuclear compromise. It was signaling willingness for compromises that he had never signaled before, including welcoming American businesses into the Iranian economy. He was doing all of those things. And then in the middle of the negotiations, the Israelis struck. And then Trump took credit for it, which then kind of blows up the idea that all of these things are coming just because the Iranian government is unnecessarily provoking. Here you have them being very seriously involved in trying to find a compromise. And it's at that moment that the Israelis decide to strike.
And is it also a case where people have observed that Iran was attacked precisely after its allies had been significantly weakened?
Exactly. I mean, much of the argument or criticism was no longer why did you support Hezbollah, but why didn't your investment in Hezbollah pay off? Why wasn't the Axis able to protect Iran? And, you know, part of the picture for that is that Iran was not able to protect the Axis. Iran was not involved when Israel was bombing Hezbollah. And I'm sure that there's plenty of people amongst the Shias in Lebanon that are disappointed with the Iranians. And similarly, the Iranians were putting pressure on the Iraqi militias not to attack the United States because of the risk of a larger confrontation. But many of these Iraqi militias have their own interests and their own reasons for opposing the U.S. that have very little to do with Iran's reasons to oppose the United States. So I think we saw that the Axis was really not much of an Axis at all, because neither of these different states movements managed to really help the other. And perhaps part of the reason for that was because of some of the intelligence successes that Israel had, particularly in taking out the leadership of Hezbollah. The one thing that ended up becoming much more popular in Iran, whereas prior to that had also been dismissed by many as some sort of a unnecessary, costly, useless investment, was Iran's ballistic missiles. That turned out to be the only element of their deterrence that actually worked. And very quickly, in a very overt, and I have to say to some extent surprising way, the government was taking advantage of this and and fusing Islamic and pre-Islamic nationalism in Iran, oftentimes centered on the efficiency of the missiles. There is a story in Iranian Iranian mythology about the war that Iran long, long time ago had with a country to the northwest called Turan. And in that, there was a soldier, after a long battle, that it was decided that the soldier would shoot his arrow, and where the arrow land would be the new border. And he put all of his life, all of his strength into that arrow. His name is Arash. And he shot it. He died because his last drop of life was in that arrow, and the arrow never landed. And since then, there's never been any war between Iran and Tehran again. And they were putting up billboards with images of Arash shooting, but not arrows, shooting missiles with his bow. So the symbolic fusion between pre-Islamic and Islamic nationalism was crucial for them, because at the end of the day, it's precisely because of the unpopularity of the Iranian government that Mossad had been successful in penetrating not only society and having all of these Mossad cells inside of Iran, but also very high up inside the Iranian government itself. And to counter that, they needed to bring the country together. And in many ways, it was the population that brought the country together, not the government.
Trita, I want to raise a couple of quick points regarding the axis. Is it that there is no axis, or is it more that Iran or Hezbollah's, its own attacks and responses vis-a-vis Israel were meant deliberately to occur without Iranian intervention early on, because that would change the dynamic sooner than Iran would have wanted, or unnecessarily would change the dynamic in a way that does not benefit Iran? And then later on, when Iran was attacked, the Syrian regime had already collapsed. Hezbollah was severely weakened, even if temporarily. And I know this is a topic of contention regarding how weakened it is. So that sort of can be an alternative explanation to what happened, as opposed to the fact that, or the contention that it's not an axis at all. So that's one point. And the second point is, isn't what happened, whether or not Iran came to the help or support of Hezbollah early on, or even after it was weakened, and vice versa, isn't this also, analytically speaking, a very powerful debunking of this really problematic take in the United States and many Western countries that Hezbollah is simply a proxy of Iran, and there's no independent thought processes or policies? Same thing with the Houthis, of course, and with the Hashd al-Shaabi and the popular forces, yeah, Shia forces in Iraq. So these are two points I would like to just to hear you.
Let me start off with the last one. You're absolutely right. I mean, it showed very much that these are independent actors. They're not proxies. Iran has an influence, but Iran's influence is not complete. The way that the whole thing has been organized has actually been organized in a manner to give these different groups as much of internal legitimacy as possible. As to your question of what really happened, and I think my take is this. The fundamental issue was not that the axis didn't exist, not that it didn't work. It's that one element, not a core element, but one element of the Axis decided to take action against Israel without the approval of the others at a time that was not favored by the others. The Iranians were playing the long strategic game. Their strategy was called strategic patience. They were taking huge hits in Syria, for instance, but they were playing the long game because they knew that in the short term, the Israelis would still have an advantage. So they were not eager to run into a conflict with the Israelis. The Israelis understood this, which is part of the reason why they became increasingly bold in their attacks that they did, because they knew that the Iranians would try to the utmost avoid it. That is still the strategy the Iranians currently have vis-a-vis the United States. They know they're not going to win a direct military confrontation with the U.S., so they want to avoid it to the extent possible. There may be a point in which it's not possible, and then I think they will fight back and perhaps Some in Washington will be surprised by the damage that the Iranians can inflict. But to the extent that they can, they want to avoid it. I think to a certain extent, Hezbollah had a similar calculation. And you're quite right. If Iran had acted much more overtly in favor of Hezbollah during that period, it would have provided the Israelis with an excuse to expand the war already back then. And the United States under Biden most likely would have caved. They would have issued a lot of press leaks about how unhappy Biden is about this and how much he screamed at Netanyahu. But at the end of the day, it would have still been a complete caving. So I think this idea that if they had done it earlier, the whole thing would have been different, I'm not so certain about that. I think at the end of the day, the fundamental reality is that there was a game played in which time was on the side in their calculation of the Axis and not on the side of Israel, and that a premature confrontation would have been to their detriment and to a very large extent. I think that is how it played out, even if it hadn't been for the taking out of much of Hezbollah's leadership. If the Iranians had just stuck to the strategic patience, they would have been eventually weakened to the point of a defeat, which is exactly why I think in this next war, because I do believe there will be another war, the Israelis will attack again.
Which is my next question. Yeah.
Right. Why don't you ask the question? And then,
all right. But that's you've alluded to it. And in fact, Trita, you've repeatedly expressed the view that renewed war against Iran is very likely. And you've even suggested that we can expect it to erupt before the end of this year. We now also appear to be on the cusp of the European signatories to the Iran nuclear agreement, Britain, France, and Germany, invoking snapback sanctions against Iran. So given these factors and what you've just said, could you explain why you think we're in this dangerous moment and how you believe this crisis might play out?
Yes. Let me answer that. And at the end of it, I'll connect it to what we talked about earlier on, why I think the Iranian strategy of strategic patience has now ended, at least vis-a-vis Israel. So Israel's objectives with its attack on June 13th were, in my assessment, threefold. And only one of these three objectives was achieved, and that one was only achieved partially. That objective was to finally get the United States into a direct military confrontation with Iran. This is something Netanyahu in particular had tried to do for more than 20 years. He finally got it, but he didn't get it to the extent that he wanted. He wanted the United States to be a full participant in this war and take out not only Iran's nuclear infrastructure, but much of its conventional military. And
the U.S. to take the lead.
Take the lead, exactly. The United States under Trump went in, but only a one-off, was in the war for essentially a day. So while it was a success for the Israelis, it was only a partial success because it was not at all what the Israelis ultimately wanted. The two other objectives were failures. First, to decapitate the regime as a whole. And even though they had intelligence successes with the killing of more than 20 or so scientists and senior military leaders, they never managed to really disrupt Iran's command and control. And within hours, the senior military leadership was replaced and the Iranians started shooting missiles at Israel that were far more successful than many had expected, including the Israelis. The third objective is the most important one. It's the overarching objective of Israel. And it's not just tied to Iran, it's tied to the region as a whole, which is that it wanted to turn Iran into another Syria or Lebanon, a country that it can bomb at will, with impunity, and without American involvement. And the last part is very important, without American involvement. The Israelis strike at Syria without U.S. involvement today. It does so as well in Lebanon. It cannot do so with Iran, however, because it needs massive American defensive support to be able to shoot down the retaliatory missiles. And it needs a lot of intelligence and other types of support to also strike at Iran. I'm sure the Israelis did not expect that the first war would reduce Iran to a new Syria. But I think they thought that it would achieve much more than it did, and that the cost of it would be much lower than it was, given the penetration of Iran's missiles of all layers of America's and Israel's air defense systems. But precisely because it is intolerable for the Israelis from their standpoint to allow any country in the region to be able to have a deterrence against Israel, they, having started this now, cannot stop. Because the more time they give...
Doubling down.
They have to double down. I'm not agreeing with them. I'm just saying this is how they calculate. If they give Iran too much time, Iran will be able to rebuild its air defense systems. It will be able to potentially buy new ones, better ones from China. It will be able to find ways to root out the Mossad infiltration inside of Iran. And the Iranians build nuclear, ballistic missiles faster than Israel and the United States can build interceptors. So time is, in that sense, not on Israel's side once it has started the clock. Now, the question, when will they strike? I have no insight into their military readiness, but I can tell you that the political window for this, in my estimation, becomes very messy once the United States enters the midterm elections. It's not to say that it's prohibitive, but this was costly for Trump. And the only reason why it didn't end up becoming much costlier is because the US's own involvement in this was very brief. And Trump presented it as if he actually had stopped the war by getting a ceasefire after 12 days. If this ended up becoming a longer war with American body bags coming home, no end in sight, no exit ramps, etc., then I think this would have been a devastating blow to him because this was not popular within the MAGA movement. And once you're in the midterm elections, it's just, it's not, again, it's not prohibitive, but it's much more difficult to foresee exactly how it will play out. So in my estimation, before December, I think this will happen. It can happen already as soon as now. There's many different factors at play here. But I would be very surprised if the Israelis don't do this. Because having started it, from their standpoint, with an opening that they thought existed, they cannot abandon it at this point. And precisely because of this, the Iranians have now more or less abandoned strategic patience. They know that their only way of dispelling Israel of any fantasy of turning Iran into that type of a country they can mow the grass with, sort of using their own expression, is to make it as costly as possible to them in this next round. Instead of hoarding missiles and playing the long game, I think the Iranians are likely to go very hard at Israel right away. Unlike what they did this time in the 12-day war, they thought it was going to be a long war, so they actually paced themselves. I don't think they will do that this time. They will go at it very hard, which will then potentially lead to mass casualty events in Israel, which would put tremendous pressure on Trump to get back into that war.
Moin, did you want to follow up or should I move forward?
Well, just briefly, where you left off, that suggests that it could very quickly escalate, whether by design or otherwise, into a confrontation that once again directly involves the U.S. And you had earlier mentioned that Trump or Washington itself might also have to learn how much damage Iran can do to U.S. facilities in the region.
Yes, absolutely. And I think my hope is that Trump tells the Israelis no, that the United States is not going to be involved in these things. I mean, look, if the United States had told Israel no months ago, so much of this devastation in the region would not have happened in the first place. Israel cannot do any of these things without active American support. I mean, CRS just came out with their numbers. About a third of Israel's military budget, a third of it, was covered by the United States in 2024. In 2025, it's likely to be much higher because of the tremendous cost of the 12-day war. Just one day of those attacks in October of 24 cost about $1.5 to $2 billion for the United States. And that was a much, much smaller thing compared to the 12-day war. So this idea that some people are spreading in Washington that Israel is now the new military hegemon of the region, that may very well be how the Netanyahu government sees itself. But what kind of hegemon has someone else pay for its war? What kind of hegemon cannot actually conduct any real war without getting massive support from a global superpower? That's not a hegemon. That is a country, in my view, that is consuming American power rather than amplifying it.
Okay.
I'm looking at the time, and I know that we have limited time. We only have about 16 or 17,000 things to discuss. So we'll try to fit them in somehow. I would like to go back, Trita, to the Iran alliances, question of Iran's alliances in the region. How have the past couple of years, well, almost the past couple of years, I'm assuming in literally less than a month, it'll be a couple of years, affected Iran's regional relationships, particularly the repeated Israeli offensives against the Axis of Resistance, and of course the collapse of the Syrian regime, which is a very important topic, and we're not going to discuss it right now, but it is not unrelated to what has been happening, especially the timing and so on. And how has this affected Iran's perception of and place in the region, taking into consideration how it has significantly improved its relations with many GCC states. And in order to keep time, I'm going to tag on in another question, and that is, what do you think is the current state of the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah? Because you can answer this as you address the first, both in terms of deterrence vis-a-vis Israel. Second, regarding the changed Lebanese political landscape itself, where Lebanon has always been a bellwether of sorts, as well as a theater of conflict. And then finally, what is Iran's position regarding the demands for Hezbollah to disarm, given it is likely to be a precursor to the return of U.S. and Saudi patronage or hegemony or domination?
Yeah. So on the first question, I think Iran's regional position obviously has been weakened as a result of the weakening of Hezbollah, the fall of the Assad regime. And I think the Iranians are trying to come to terms with that. But it's important to understand that two other things have simultaneously also happened, which in some ways points in the opposite direction, and they're related. One is that even prior to this, there was a significant warming of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Iran and the UAE. This, in my view, is primarily driven by the fact that these two countries came to the conclusion, belatedly, but correctly, that the United States was not going to come to their defense in any war with Iran, or most likely with anyone, because the attitude of the Trump administration under Trump won. When Iran attacked Saudi oil fields in 2019, after the Saudis had played a pivotal role in squeezing out Iran's oil exports as part of maximum pressure that Trump pursued at the time, the Saudis expected that the United States would come in and follow the Carter Doctrine and protect Saudi Arabia. But Trump made it very clear to them that that was an attack on Saudi. It was not an attack on the United States. This shocked the kingdom. But then something else happened a couple of years later. The Houthis attacked Abu Dhabi. And guess what? The president's name now was Joe Biden. And he did the same thing. The Emiratis expected protection, an attack on the Houthis. Instead, the Biden administration issued a press release. And even the use of the Patriots that were stationed in the Emirates, the United States sent an invoice for how much it would cost if they were to be used. So this made it clear that this is not a Trump thing. This is an American thing. The United States, in my view, correctly, is not going to willy-nilly get itself involved in every conflict in the region. And as a result, it meant that these countries no longer could hide behind American military power. If you can't hide behind American military power and you have bad relations with a powerful neighbor, guess what? It makes diplomacy with that neighbor much more attractive, because now you have to find a way of resolving those tensions because you cannot hide behind American military power. So you saw a flurry, intensification of regional diplomacy taking place after 2019 in particular. And that eventually led to the signing of this agreement, normalization between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which the main lion's share of that work was done by Iraq and by Oman, but the Chinese were needed to get it over the finishing line. So now you had a situation in which those countries no longer were in the Israeli camp hoping the United States would go to war with Iran, because they recognized that that would be very bad for them. Then you have the weakening of Iran regionally, which then makes the concerns about Iran not go away, but not as acute as they may have been in the past in some GCC capitals. But then you have another thing that we just saw the manifestation of today, but it already started early on, which was the United States had to
That was the Jadalia interview that they conducted with Trita Parisi on the issue of Iran and the regional situation. I would encourage you to listen to the whole thing on the Jadalia podcast. Thank you, and we'll be talking to you next Wednesday at 2 p.m. This is Zain Lamine signing off from the Shai Onana Show.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Israeli troops and tanks pushed deeper into Gaza City today as Israel's major ground offensive aimed at occupying the area enters a second day. The Israeli military repeated warnings today for residents to evacuate the city, where nearly 1 million Palestinians have been living. Israel said it had opened up an additional route for 48 hours that Palestinians could use to leave as Israel steps up efforts to force more people to flee their homes for overcrowded and unsafe areas in the south. Many Palestinians say they are unable or unwilling to move south due to the rising costs associated with the journey and fear of permanent displacement. In related news, the heads of more than 20 aid agencies working in Gaza have called on world leaders to urgently intervene in the war, following the first ever determination by a United Nations commission that Israel is perpetuating genocide in the devastated territory. With an estimated 65,000 Palestinians killed in Israeli attacks so far in Gaza, the agencies warned today that almost 1 million more people are now on the precipice of an even deadlier period in Gaza if action is not taken. The aid groups said, quote, states must use every available political, economic, and legal tool at their disposal to intervene. Rhetoric and half measures are not enough. This moment demands decisive action, close quote. Signatories to the statement include Islamic Relief Worldwide, CARE International, Save the Children International, and Doctors Without Borders. In other news, in the Caribbean, the U.S. steps up deadly military action against drug traffickers as the Venezuelan government protests. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
When leaving for London yesterday, President Trump insisted that the U.S. destroyed three boats outbound from Venezuela, when the military has only documented two such instances. The president has been clear to label the drug traffickers as, quote, narco-terrorists, end quote, named after the deadly narcotics which have been smuggled into the country. While the military action in the Caribbean is limited to these drug traffickers, the Venezuelan government has been furious about U.S. actions. Maduro, the dictator who espouses the socialist ideas of his far more popular predecessor, Hugo Chavez, is leading the complaints. Maduro has no interest in working alongside U.S. authorities and sees the entire operation as a warmongering threat to his country.
And in more news, in Washington, D.C., the Trump administration continues to federalize the Capitol by changing laws related to crime. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Yesterday, lawmakers in the House approved a bill which would allow 14-year-olds in D.C. to be tried as adults. Many states, including Maryland and Virginia, allow for 14-year-olds to be charged as adults in very heinous crimes, and it is always appealable. But in D.C., this process will likely not be appealable. As part of his overarching plan to federalize the district, President Trump has called for multiple changes in the district's laws.